I am very privileged today. We are talking about Future Unlocked and how two business titans generated over $50 billion in global commerce and what is next. So yeah, it's a pretty in-depth conversation we're going to have today. We're going to dig into how they managed to achieve such extraordinary success, and they will share some of the most relevant lessons that they have both learned along the way. I'm joined by Richard Morris, who built a technology business that floated for $2.6 billion, and regular guest Stephen J. Manning, who has been responsible for tens of billions in of dollars in commerce over the last 5 decades. So welcome to you both. It's lovely to see you.
Hi, thank you. Thank you. Lovely to meet you.
So, yeah, I mean, I think first question really, walk us through your journey to generating billions in impact, Richard, first, please.
When I hear you say that, part of me does think I'm on the wrong show, right? Anyway, but in terms of it was, I co-founded a business, so I'm a co-founder in the States, and it floated for just over $2.3 billion, and that was one of the largest floats. But you know, I was thinking, okay, how did that come to be? And part of me will say I was in the right place at the right time with the right skills around the right team. And because it all did come together. But of course, if you trace that back, I was very fortunate. I had a love of technology. I had a love of how do I create impact in whatever team I'm in? How do I make a difference? And that, I suppose, saw me good to actually, why would someone bother to invite me to be in a founding team? And ultimately, it was because I had a love of technology and I have a love of hopefully good leadership, although at that time it was more theory than practice, if you like. And yeah, and obviously I hopefully fairly good at something. And I was fortunate that about 2 years before that, I hadn't been quite so good. I was not taking responsibility for things. And I'd read a good book of wisdom by Stephen Covey that was effectively a good slap around the face to say, be accountable, be a leader, get on with it and stop moaning. So that was really good. And then the team, you know, 8 of us started it. It grew. It was of its time. It was building out broadband. Looking back on it, I found what I loved the most was being part of something that had a purpose and actually contributing towards building a great culture to get results. That's what I loved. And I was very fortunate that I had such great people around me that attracted even more great people around me. So that was that. And then when I came back to the UK to do it again, it didn't work out. And I suppose I might even consider wilderness times. I was a bit lost. I didn't find my way. It was really troubling. And I volunteered and I did bits and pieces stuff. But I enjoyed being dad and I enjoyed being husband. But I struggled to really find a place work-wise that or to fulfill that. And in the end, I thought, actually, why don't I build a charity to give money away? And I teamed up with other people because I like being part of teams. So you could almost say selfishly, I created a thing that would suit me. And I still run that. It's a passion project, but it has had reasonable impact. We've given away just over £2.5 million, which although in some ways doesn't seem a lot, but it's to thousands of smaller organizations around the UK to help them with their impact. And now, and then I discovered this thing called EOS, which I loved as a methodology, wish I'd known about it, and put that into place in my own charity, helped others adopt it, and sort of almost like an advert said, actually, I love it so much. I met someone who said, you should really come and teach and mentor and coach companies to do this. So I joined the team to do that. So ultimately, that was a little bit of my journey is in a nutshell. And for all of those times, you know, especially in the US one, I did start that journey with a fair bit of hair. But the startup experience, I swapped finance for follicles and it was a good swap.
So how about you then, Steve? Walk us through a bit of your journey on generating billions in commerce.
Well, let me just go backwards because recently in a talk, somebody asked me just how did you get from where you started to later on in your career? And you know, because I had started that, you know, in my teens. I had the privilege of being penniless, a refugee, you know, on two continents, U.S. being the second one. And so, you know, it's like, and then the man followed up. This was a 150 suits, downtown business suits. And the man says, and okay, so what was the best job you've ever had? He was, for some reason, upset. Maybe he didn't like the chicken for lunch. But so I said, actually, the best and worst job were the same that I've had. When I was 16, I was hustling people on tennis courts. I was a righteous player. And then one day I needed more money because my parents didn't have any money to give me. Then I was saying the fact that my dad was a world-class scientist, but that was in the old country, not in the brave new world of the United States. So I got myself a job at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, which is a massive enterprise. And I got a job cleaning rat cages in the research labs. Explain. Well, you know, go to a beautiful building, everything shiny, antiseptic, lights are on. And then you go down four floors and lights are on, antiseptic, it's all fine. And then you walk through the double doors and then you find out why God created trash cans. Because you get the scent. And then you throw up. And you throw up for 8 hours. So it's a great job for three reasons. One, fantastic for diet. Two, it paid 24 cents an hour more than anything else I could get, and nobody else wanted it. And three, I learned a very, very interesting lesson about life, business, about righteous work, honest pay, and all of that. That was life-changing for me as a kid. So I said, so that's my less than auspicious beginning. And I needed like a real full-time job. I somehow got through college. It's a mystery, but she remains a mystery to me. I want to work for this little marketing business here, which 2 years later was insolvent, going bankrupt. And fortunately, I was about to get fired when boss walked in and says, you know how to do that, which was the marketing plan going forward. And I had exactly two options. To be honest, say I have no clue and get fired then, or to lie and say, sure. He got fired a couple of weeks later when he figured out I didn't know how to do it. That's one of the precepts of my talk on success, on the pillar of success, which is you say yes when everyone else says no. And then when I retired from that business, I was in my 30s. And by then, we had a few million square feet and many thousands of employees. And the company became probably the most financially successful privately owned business in an industry. I had something to do with it, I humbly state, and then I decided I needed to see the world, which I didn't get much of that because, of course, 3 weeks into my retirement, I was going to commit suicide out of boredom. Then, for all the wrong reasons, zero plan, zero idea what I was going to do, I started a business in the former Iron Curtain countries, Hungary. It was, you know, quoting a great lyric, Goodman Brown, how can love so bad go so good? And I write about this. It's just my mom called me one day and say, honey, can you put these people to work? Turned out I had to hire ethics and I had to prove that in a matter of 3 months, we went from my mom calling to big buildings. I ultimately gave that business to the employees because going public was just, I couldn't do that time in the world. And then I discovered the internet. Well, actually, Al Gore created it. I just discovered it later. We were very early on, probably in the first 10 or so people on the backbone. And we blew that opportunity in a very big way because we thought of it as a business rather than an equity play. So we did create a couple of interesting things. I said, why don't I just buy the media for us instead of that agency? There's 100 people who we feed. So by myself with an assistant, we bought the media instead of 50 people. And then an agency happens. At the end, I'm doing business with 75 global brands. and you learn a great deal from them, and they learn some from you. And then keeping on the same track with the interested people you meet and so on. And I'm glad to share the stuff. And then you sell stuff because it's just, oh, that's a good opportunity. So you sell holy water from the Holy Land. Really? Well, 50 attorneys generals thought it was okay. And then you sell horse manure in South America. I'm happy to share. I was a horse manure king in South America for a little while. That business was born on an airplane on a night flight from LA to Santiago. And so just make a list. It's a terrible moniker that you can sell ice to the Eskimo in the winter, which is nonsense. Holiday colored specific ice, perhaps. So, you know, you grow into that world, and you grow, and you say yes when everyone else says no. And you never consider failure an option. It's a way of life. Also, yeah, one like of the other that. Precepts that drives this for me is life is not a dress rehearsal for me. You know, I was a penniless teenager in Rome, had no money, zero. We ate pasta and bread three times a day for a year, courtesy of some agency, Red Cross. And I woke up one day with an idea that life is not a dress rehearsal. Happens to be I was sneaking into dress rehearsal at the Italian Opera, which I did every day. And, you know, I said, no, it's not, we're only doing this today. We may never do it again. And all this stuff, and that's, I think, a cornerstone of a lot of successful people. The cornerstone is all that stuff. There's something I'm going to do. I want to do that. I want to see that. Someday I will go there. I can't tell how many times I went there with zero expectation of paying for it. But I said, what am I going to do it when I'm this old and decrepit? No, I'm going to do it when I'm young. I can enjoy it. Life is not a dress rehearsal. That takes you to things that come your way. I have spent more hours on airplanes unnecessarily, it seems, than you'd believe. Because I happen to sit next to a guy like you, and we're chatting, and, oh, gee, the flight's landing in Paris, and I'm going to Vienna, and you're going to Istanbul. Hold that. Buy a ticket for $1,800 and sit next to Richard for another 4 hours, because you may never get that opportunity again. I think that's the key to pursuing success. And, yeah, I've ended up in various parts of the world I didn't intend to because I didn't meet some interesting people on the way. And even that's discounting the guys, this kind of guys were selling stolen enriched uranium from Chechnya. But it makes a hell of a story.
We're going to dig into that, Steve, in another conversation. We have plenty of these in our archives. So if you want to hear that story, then drop us a message. But on to the next question. Richard, what's the biggest misconception people have about operating at your scale, sort of when you were building that big business that you guys floated?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think I would perhaps talk about my own misconception. I remember before we were going to do the IPO, there was a major swap out of the founders to bring in known names to increase the value of the offering. And it so happened that, you know, I was looking to go home to the UK because my wife was pregnant and we wanted to start a family. So a number of new people started coming in, and we had a new CEO. And I thought, wow, I'm going to get a chance to see how these really impressive heavy hitters do things. Right. Because, you know, we were amateurs, but we made good, if you like. We created this business. And it was really disappointing, really disappointing, because I'll keep the story short, but I met the new CEO that took over for the first time on Halloween. And I know it's Halloween because I was the only one of the management team that decided to dress up with the rest of the staff. So I met my new CEO dressed as Austin Powers. So not sure whether I made the best impression, but anyway, and I did have a wig on, yes. So anyway, so I'm dressed in this blue velour sort of thing. And anyway, she said, what's your view of the, you know, what feedback do you have for me in the management meeting? And I was used to, I used to help run the management meetings from a coordination perspective. And I, but I wasn't once they got new people in. And I said, well, you know, when you talk and actions are taken, I said, no one's making any notes. I said, how do you know these actions are getting done? And I'm, bear in mind, running a pretty big business now, you know, 1,000 odd people. And I'm, how do you know shit's getting done? I don't see it. And this is at the leadership team. So next meeting we go to, what was so funny is she then said, right, I want to see everyone else with pens and pencils out. I want to see people writing stuff down so we know stuff's going to get done. And I suppose just part of me was, I was very disillusioned. I was very disappointed because I thought once you get into these upper echelons, people just really have their shit together. And they don't. And I think that, so what have I learned? I thought, actually, do you know what? Anyone can be really good at this stuff. And if you believe you can't be, you're probably thinking other people are better than they are. And, you know, I was just so disappointed with what I thought were going to be the highest caliber people I was going to be around. Some of them were, don't get me wrong, but actually the people I'd already grown up around and we developed leaders around us were far higher caliber than some of the ones I met that were brought in just for being faces on the prospectus. So perhaps that's probably one of the biggest lessons that I had.
Interesting. Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense that. I mean, I think it's like if you think you can do something, you can do it, right? And the confidence you build, you have abilities to do anything that you want, right? I mean, that's the beauty.
Well, I think the other thing about leadership, and I this is why I do quite like the EOS philosophy, is there's two ingredients, right? Is you've got to want to be a great leader and you've got to love your people. Or at least care for them, you know? And, you know, so because then you've got this Darwinian evolution of it's not fixed, you evolve and you want to be great and you spot when you've not been the best you could have been and you get better. And that comes with experience. You can get a lot from theory and reading, but ultimately with the human being, it's a human experience. You said it's not a dress rehearsal. So over time you pick up the experience, you realize how things work and don't work. And I said to you before, I didn't always enjoy certain aspects of my childhood moving around all over the place, but actually it taught me a lot of how to get on with people and different types of people. And actually that's where it really started to help is, you know, how can you relate to people or at least try to help lead them well.
100%. So how about you, Steve? What's the biggest misconception people have about operating at your scale?
You know, if I may, Richard, share Richard's wisdom here. I grew up in a baby company that was bankrupt, but I did have the privilege of going through all the various plateaus of this business, you know, entrepreneurial, where the founders, who are ultimately the best people to lead a company, which is a very specific notion, which I learned. That's the disillusionment part. The founders count the paperclips because every paperclip is theirs. And then you hire some managers because you can't do that. And then you feel all the stuff that goes along with losing control. And then you digress. And then you hire professional management people who begin to make some decisions. The founders, the entrepreneurs, freak. They're losing control of their baby. Somebody else is not counting the paper clips properly. Then you digress. Move on. Eventually, the business outgrows them from a moving parts perspective. And then you have that moment where you're going to hire that CEO or the CF this and the C to see that, because that is now your self-image and the business demands it. Mm-hmm. And now you hire that CEO whose job is not to drive the truck, whose job is to make sure the wheels don't fall off the truck. So by definition, the whole notion of creativity driving the business forward disappears. The singly most effective senior exec is a founder or a founder type who finds regained interest in doing this. Now, the thing that is the most dangerous about, or whatever the adjective is that you and I have a big business that functions well, and you hire the big gatekeepers. And then you realize that you're hiring the MBA mentality. The MBA mentality is I have to do what I've got to do, but I cannot fail. And that's a very specific mentality. And what happens then is that that's the head, the totem factum, who drives the thing with a very specific purpose. If I generate 2% after tax, next year 2.1, 2.2, 2.4, I'm performing admirably. Meanwhile, yeah, the founders.
Although I have to say, and just to interrupt, one of the things that I did notice that a couple of people after the business floated, you know, 9 months down the line, they weren't with the business anymore. So to some degree, there were a placement just to get the thing. But it was just, but some people were brilliant. And it was just interesting of seeing the fact that I'd had that assumption that when you get to a certain level, by definition, I thought, wow, I'm going to learn a lot. And I didn't learn as much as I thought I would.
You may have learned something about ordinary processes.
Yes, I did.
Running that business that way. But the reality is that the executive manager person, not manager, executive leader person, forgets the part where he also has to be an elite manager. Otherwise, the business won't need him or fail him. That's okay. And two, a lot of these people run businesses by inertia. It's working okay. Let's not break the mold. And, you know, another Manningism, to newborn, every joke is new. I don't care that we've done this way for 20 years. The world moves around us very quickly. Things are changing. The rate of change in every aspect of that big business is vertiginous, starting with technology, starting with, human resources. Well, we've done it this way. We did 2%. I can do it this way. We'll do two. No. That will cascade into oblivion. And those people who have this edict, work edict, there's room for them. As a CEO, I want that guy working for me with a clear mandate. I drive the truck so hard that you'll get dizzy. Your job is to make sure the wheels don't fall off. So put the processes and systems in place that I can, they're transparent to me, that I can monitor. I can sit there and say, wait a second, I don't want to do that. Okay, so the thing that running a big business, I have found, is beyond the comprehension of most people who talk about running a big business. I have been in a company of wonderful theoreticians. There's certainly need for that. And a lot of talking heads, certainly, and some of the best purveyors of work salads. And at some point, you sit in that big room and say, excuse me, you work here, you're a C-suite guy, a woman. Have you ever made payroll? What do you mean? Have you ever been in a place where you had to make payroll? Well, we have people for that. No. Ultimately, when you pull into that parking lot on Saturday going to the show, and you have a person with a yellow thing directing to you, say, oh, Mr. Morris, please park here. You can get out easily. I said, well, thank you. And he said, by the way, who are you? Oh, I work for you. I work in that building over there. I got news for you. If that person is worried about the paycheck clearing, you're going to park 9 blocks away. And as you walk by, this person is going to make a very unpopular gesture at you. You said something about leadership, about your people. You know, first of all, but for people, business would be a snap. But have you tried to run your business by yourself with all your brilliance, everything you bring to that picnic, without all these people? So who do you recruit and why? And what did you do with that? The highlights, without a doubt, of my little career are people. And they are kids. The young people who were in the enterprise where we recognized what their potential might be. And when you drag people by the hair, to take that managerial job to say, I don't know how to do this. Yeah, but you know what? You had an idea. I now have 5 miles of conveyor belts going the wrong direction because of you. It's working better. How about you're on that thing? And the kid looks at you, are you kidding? I barely speak English. Happens to be a real example. That kid runs distribution for biggest parts company in the country today. But the people, and it's the thing that is astounding to me. You live in a big house. You drive this big enterprise. When was the last time you walked through all those buildings, meet those people? Okay. I was privileged to have a mentor when I was young. He happened to be, he ran operations for the little company I grew up in, retired. And then when the whole thing was forced on me, he was my consultant. And every morning at 6 o'clock, we would walk through 3 big buildings, say hello, shake hands, meet people. It took me a year to get them to call me Steve instead of Sir or Jefe. And I did that at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I did that at 2 in the morning because we ran 3 shifts. And I shook hands with a lot of people. And pretty soon I began to understand the families, the kids, and all that. And pretty soon I'd walk in and I would take our analysts for little walks. Introduce some people. You know these people? I got to know them. And when you walk up to the kid, the guy say, listen, congratulations, I heard your wife had a baby. Jefe, how do you know this? Well, we had spies. Well, I know this. Now, the people, those people, we paid a living wage. We employed everybody 50 weeks out of the year, which was absolutely unusual in our world. Nobody went hungry. Nobody went without a doctor. That's just what we did. And the manifestation of that, your people, those are your people, you know, is when the word goes out that we need some people to volunteer to work a midnight graveyard shift on Christmas Eve, you have 98% volunteers.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because you say that, and I know one of the, you know, how would you convince someone? And you said, because the facts are there. And one of the things that was interesting about what you're saying is in it, I was a trustee of a local YMCA for a number of years. And one of the things I like about the call to action is to enable young people to belong, contribute, thrive, right? But if you take the young people out, you know, and we were talking before the show went live, is human beings, we're kind of pack animals, right? So we need to belong. And when we can belong, we can have an opportunity to contribute. And by definition, then we feel we're thriving, right? And one of the biggest human conditions is we are disconnected. So, and given that we're going to spend so much time in a work environment, if we create a place where people feel like they belong, yeah, you've got to have metrics, you've got to do all this sort of stuff, but the belonging piece, then we give them the job function and support to actually contribute. Their mental health goes up, the sick days go down, the performance goes up. Even if you only look at the spreadsheet and the outcome, it makes sense. It's almost dumb to consider anything else. So it's sort of fun, and it's so obvious that you kind of think, why doesn't everyone do this? But I wanted to just highlight one other thing that was quite interesting is, you know, people behave differently in those kind of environments. And you spoke about the fact you were in the rat environment. You know, you were talking about the rats. At some interesting studies showing that actually when you did the experiments on the rats, especially for drug addiction and habit-forming substance abuse, when you put the rats on their own, they perform very differently than when you put them in a family group, because rats are community-based organisms and beings as well. So they behave differently in supportive groups. They didn't exhibit some of those same tendencies because they were in a stressed environment on their own. So it's just very interesting. Again, we come back to a systemic level of we operate better in groups. And if you look at it, most of the charities and stuff we talk about are creating places for people to belong. So why wouldn't you want to create a workspace where people feel like they belong? You're going to get far more productivity out of them. They're going to enjoy it. It's kind of a win-win, right? And it's so intrinsically obvious. You think, why do so many people not get that? I just, the evidence is there, the numerics are there, and you've just spoken about it. It's so bloody obvious. I just don't understand why it's not.
I'm going to have to censor that now. Seriously, I'm going to have to put an X rating on this show now. I don't know what to do, to be honest.
Why was it X rated?
Because you said bloody.
I was thinking I didn't go full. But it's not me.
You know, Richard, something you said, and I heard this. Again, I was a young guy, way too much influence and ability to change lives of our people, to be sure. And I've heard this from other people, like, man, you guys are really mercenary. I said, I'm confused. I had happened to be at dinner with some folks. I happened to relate a story that in our buildings, we had employee counselors, otherwise known as spies. And, you know, they kind of knew that everybody. And they knew that guy and that woman, ooh, they knew that was a family. They didn't want to, they knew that stuff. And two stories that happened pretty much simultaneously. One of the employee counsel walked up to this woman. She was a warehouse worker, and she was pregnant. And he walked up to her and said, I'm going to take you to the doctor. She said, no, I'm okay. And he says, you're not okay. You need to see. We had a clinic on a retainer in some valley, Pacoima, California. They were very happy to get our money. Anyway, and no, I'm taking the doctor. He dragged the doctor. Now, the way that came up is that somebody related to her said, mentioned to John, the employee counselor, that that woman's not doing well. Bad pregnancy, she's not healthy. She's working a factory environment, a production environment floor. So he dragged her to a clinic because clearly there was an issue. Two things happened. One, next morning, some woman showed up who claimed to be her. No. It's my social security card, my license. Okay. She was a cousin. She did not want to lose the job, and she didn't want to create a hole in her little line of what she was doing. So the cousin worked 2 months until she gave birth. And it was kind of funny. It was like, hey, how you doing? I'm good. How you doing? Okay. It took better part of 1 hour for thousands of employees in buildings scattered to know that we took her to a doctor. Okay? What does it, you know, to belong is one of the basic human needs, you know, food, need for food and shelter, to belong, recognition, all of that. 2 days, 3 or 4 days later, one of these guys comes and says, our head electrician got paid, went to Vegas, blew the paycheck, he's got 5 kids. I said, okay. He said, okay, well, you know, we don't want to lose him. He's a jerk, he drinks too much, but he's great. We don't want to lose him. I said, you think about losing him? I can hire electricians. But he's been working for 8 years. He's got 4 or 5 kids. Oh, I don't care about him. I care about the kids. He doesn't have a savings account. So John took the guy to our local McDonald's. Well, he ordered 400 hamburgers, 400 orders of French fries. Now think about how much that costs. And said, okay, until your next paycheck, the kids are going to eat McDonald's. Oh, happy days. And the guy was sitting in a car crying. And I said, okay, now understand this is not for you, it's for the kids. Because ultimately, I had to talk to him and I said, two things. First of all, the kids will eat McDonald's, they'll be happy. Two, next time you drink the paycheck, you and your wife who also works here, your cousin who worked here, are unemployed. Don't drink the paycheck away. That took about an hour until I got some phone calls from management in that building said, what you do? I mean, all these people talking about the hamburgers. Hmm. You know, the guy's a drunk. What you do? I said, it's the kids. I care about him, but not that much. We care about the kids. That's what we do. Which, again, takes me back to the part where at the toughest part of our year, which is Christmas season, January 1st, we need some volunteers to work on New Year's Eve. 98% said, I'm there, not for the extra hours. Because they began to understand they were the only people in this kind of factory environment in the San Fernando Valley that works 50 weeks a year. You know what? If you don't respect your people, and particularly certain ethnic groups, you're not going to get the respect. You respect them, what you get back is invaluable.
100%.
And I 100%. Certainly respect it.
That's very, it's almost like the, you know, fundamentally, it's servant leadership. You ultimately, you know, yeah, of course you want to drive results, but you have to trust and serve your people to do that. And there's a lot of trust in that. The other thing that struck me as well, I hope you don't mind me riffing off that. Another thing that was very interesting about the YMCA experience I had, it was about 9 years I was doing that, was sometimes you saw young people in a very, because this particular place I was a trustee of was a hostel for young people that were going through quite, and they needed significant, they had significant support needs. But you see people at an instant in time in their lives, and we form judgments about that. But, and especially so some of the young people we might have seen later on, they might reoffend in some of the stuff they did. Sometimes they might, you know, actually be able to climb out of the hole that we're in. And sometimes they're the people that are going back into school years later, talking and educating people to avoid drugs or do whatever. And so you never know what the range of futures holds for an individual you see at that moment in time, the pain they're in or whatever. So when you see someone that's doing some of those behaviors, sometimes, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean you go soft, but you actually say, I'm only seeing them at this moment in time through this experience. Who and are you able to play a part in creating a better future for them? But accepting the fact that sometimes this is out of your control. They're going to have to bounce back. And sadly, you know, sometimes these same people, they may not be around in 5 years' time. You can't control that. But you can control how you behave, how you respond at that moment in time and remain professional, supportive as best, the best version of yourself you can be. And but it, ultimately, they've got to make those decisions and those journey pieces. And that sounds like what you were doing. And of course, you can always look back, but at the moment in time when you make decisions based like that, to me, I look back and I think I don't really have any regrets about some of the things I've done, because actually at that moment of choice, if you're led by what you feel is what's the right thing to do at this moment in time, generally speaking, it never lets you down. You might get new information later that you didn't have, but if you look back, you think, well, I wouldn't have made a different choice at that moment in time anyway. That is the right thing to do, whatever that made sense. And that, to some degree, then hopefully sets an example for the other leaders around you to say, you know, sometimes you just need to think a little bit bigger, because that's, unfortunately, that goes part and parcel. That's the deal with leadership. It's a parental type role. And the rap stops with you to some degree. If things don't work out, it's your fault. And if things do work out, you generally have to praise your kids. The people that work for you, right? That's the deal. Right.
Really, just one question for both of you on AI transformation, because that's just like it's a massively important topic right now. Yeah. And it fits into the leadership and it fits into the people management side of things, which is kind of what we've been talking about, right? So yeah. I think the most important question at the moment is, where do most executives get AI implementation wrong? Because so many of these cases of digital transformation at the moment are absolutely failing. And yeah. I think that the actual facts are, I think it's either 85 or 98%. It's one or the other, I forget. There's so many stats out there, but they're basically, that's the sort of figures that we're talking about. So Where do you think
right
on this, Richard, they're failing, these executives? Well,
obviously, so I'm going to share an opinion. And as we said before, my opinion's about as good as anyone else's. But from my perspective, right, one of the things I think is, you know, AI is new. It's new. And although it isn't new, but it is new in a way in the scale it is. And of course, like anything that's new, lots of people have opinions and lots of people tell you it's going to do this and it's going to do that. And actually, the reality we know is going to be different, but we don't know where it's going to be different because actually it's an experiential thing that's evolving. The thing that is different is evolving very quickly. So I think where do I think some of the mistakes are? Well, first of all, a lot of it will be looking at where can we replace people? And one of the things that I think with a lot of this is that it reminds me of the early days of enterprise management systems, you know, where you could actually codify processes. And it works. But what you forget is most people who run processes never codified precisely what that process was. There were a lot of little manual things. There were a lot of little things that humans did in those processes. So as soon as you codified them into a big system, a machine, things broke because we forgot that Steve over there, oh, yeah, we run that process. But Steve often tells, you know, Bob over here something that was never codified. So I think with this, you can automate something when you really understand it. But often with human stuff, we don't always really understand it. So I think the misconception perhaps is maybe we can't automate everything we thought we could. And we will have to learn from that. And the experiential knowledge you have is in people is still valuable. What I think is then the other query then, or the issue is, but I think AI has a huge part to play in how do we become better versions of ourselves to manage data, to see the bigger picture, to actually have good advice and knowledge. But I often think it's probably not a very politically correct thing to say, but I'd say AI to me is a very highly autistic, and I mean that in a very positive way, very focused thing, but overconfident assistant. Because it'll give you results that it thinks with 100% accuracy is right, and you will need to assess that. So I think part of it is really playing with it and educating yourself. What is this thing? What can it do? What it can't do? So I think there's an education piece and the fact that it will enable us to automate so many things and see the data and see and analyze things on a much bigger scale, which then hopefully we could humanize where we really need to humanize. Because I think there's still a massive place for humanization of making sure we're still human beings. And going back to what we said before is ultimately the human condition is one about belonging. So even if you've got companies that fully run on automation and create all this kind of stuff, brilliant, right? Fantastic. But we're still going to have a bunch of human beings to deal with, right? Unless we kill them all, and we're not going to do that. So the point is we're still going to have to work on the human level as well. So what do I think some of the biggest challenges for some of the leaders is, A, you're going to have to learn what this stuff is, what it can't do. You're going to have to play with it to begin with and not just listen to other people's opinions. You've got to have to figure it out. You have to look at your business model and maybe get some great advice on where could it play? Where could it add value to what we do and how we serve our customers, how we manage stuff and people? And except, yeah, we'll change people's job descriptions and maybe change things. But maybe it won't do it quite the way everybody's been telling us that it will. And you know, Darwinian evolution is in play here. The strongest propositions will survive. So we've got to roll with the changes. We don't know what we don't know. It's too big. So surely part of it is be curious, be open, be childlike, fascinated of this is really cool. But we don't really know yet what impact it's going to have.
Yeah, that's a good explanation. Very much.
Well, I don't know.
We've been doing a lot of talking around. But we've been doing a lot of talking around this, and I know Steve's got some insights because he was involved with AI and data like back in the 80s. So he's got a different opinion. Maybe he agrees. I don't know. What do you think, Steve?
Well, I can't argue with anything our esteemed friend said because this insight is so spot on. I look at it from moving through history for decades now, I think the biggest issue is the over-reliance of what I think is a nascent, fantastic thing. AI is phenomenal. AI is beyond comprehension of most people, but it is still nascent. And the over-reliance, the CEO says, well, I've got this issue. We need to fix it. And well, just throw it at AI. We'll get our answers. And then at some point in time, when things start to fall apart, break down, often at the human level, the humans are not doing what they're supposed to do, you find a really cool term called hallucinations. Mm-hmm. AI is hallucinating.
Yeah.
You talk about early enterprise systems, early computer systems, if you will. Oh, the old story, you know, garbage in, garbage out.
Right.
Well, you feed this thing garbage, it creates the most phenomenal paradigms of things to be done. Here's the reasoning for it. This is what should happen. And you find out that it's entirely wrong, because it's the first and most important thing is the question is not well thought out. So you end up with incredible biases. The data you put in it, in a matter of 3 or 4 or 5 hours, I can go and create a phenomenal quote and attribute it to you.
Yeah.
And of course, Elon Musk will tell me.
I want to come in on a very small thing, and it reminds me I'm level 58, 59. So I don't talk ages because it's the game of life, right? So, and every year feels like an achievement. But I remember when we first had Microsoft Word when it first came out, and you could produce documents, right? And it was text-based stuff, and then Lotus Amy Pro came out, and suddenly we had WYSIWYG, right? And you could create reports and you could do stuff. The content of the report was the same, or it could even be worse, but it looked beautiful. So we could create reports that look lovely now, but the content could be crap. So what I do think is, it's like we can get really nice structured responses, and it looks all beautifully laid out, but do we know the content's any good? And sometimes it is, and sometimes it won't be, but it'll still look beautiful all the same.
It is even more critical in that you're training your AI. Okay, so every time I ask Elon Musk a question, sorry, I prefer to call it Elon Musk rather than Grok.
Right,
ChatGPT or any. And by the way, I'm blown away by the capacity of this. You are training your AI. The lickety split, the thing will know my biases. Therefore, by definition, what I get back has biases that I introduced in the training data.
Yeah.
And then when I ask an ordinary question, it recognizes that I'm overgeneralizing topics, patterns, and so on. And that's what I get back. What I get back, as you said, is phenomenal, wonderful, it's terrific. Unfortunately, also messed up. You know, how phenomenal is it that I can create a fictional character just by interrogating AI going down 2 or 3 levels? And what I'm going to get back is a biography of Nathaniel Richard. With a bio that's absolutely phenomenal. So the question is this, and we talk about this a great deal. So it's use, misuse, and abuse. We're not quite, we're the abuse because there are already massive schemes abusing AI.
They're usually the first two to emerge, aren't they, really?
Without a doubt. My point here is this, and it's funny we talked about this at length in another round table. Is okay, so I go to a company and they have this incredible issue, and I tell you what, they have more resolutions to the issue than I can count, and they go from sterile to more sterile to absolutely mechanical, for lack of a better term. And then I sit there, so I'm a little bit confused by this. So have we asked the guys in Kuala Lumpur who run that assembly line? Why? Wait, look at this data. It's phenomenal, says the CEO. I say, well, consider me limited. you know, and I go back to say, hey, the newborn, every joke is new. I don't know why that's going that way and should maybe should not. I don't know. Well, the AI, and look at the investment we made in this technology. And then I venture forth gingerly rather than with tremendous fortitude to say, maybe we have a meeting. What do you mean? Let's bring together all the people, distinct touches. Because I have found out that the dude running the assembly line knows a lot more than the ladies telling me what how I messed up and the CEO who bought into this thing. You know, and it's possible the guy sweeping the factory floor knows even more. But then, okay, so now all of a sudden you have a meeting of 20 people. And the C-suite is confused. Why are these people here? Well, I don't know how to tell you this, but somebody's got to figure out how to put the thing in the box. And this is the guy, you know, that woman, you know. And then,
well, I suppose
then you get into the most elegant part of this, which is when you sit there and you design the hierarchy of where these people sit in the big conference room. Because they want to fade into the wall. It's my boss and his boss sitting there. I'm not going to be a contrarian. To which then you get people like me who say, I put place cards down. So the most junior person happens sitting in the middle seat across from the window, right behind, right at the window, the power seat in the room. Boy, it confuses a lot of people because they learned that in grad school. And then you put those people and explain to them, this is an open forum. We're going to do this like Steve Jobs used to do. Everybody has the same voice. And privately, you reach out to these people at a time and say, if you don't speak up, you're never going to get invited again. Okay.
But I guess
at the end of 2 hours,
what's that,
you know exactly what to ask the AI to do. My point is, 2 hours into that, now you know what to ask AI to do.
Well, I was going to say, the thing is, though, is even if you, the point I think with AI that is very good is it can take a huge amount of disparate data and see the, some of the connections, or at least give some highlight.
Well, that's the usage.
Which is where, that's where the benefit is. And you were saying earlier about, you know, if you want to know what's going on in the company, to me, you either speak to people on the front door, you manage the door, or you speak to the assistants. They always, the people on the front door and people on the assistants always know what's going on in the business.
The amazing thing to me, more than anything else, and that's what I forge ahead courageously and mightily, that 3 hours into this meeting, you find out that that woman should really be running that show, not that guy. That is the value proposition from having that guy or that woman over here. And then you say, by the way, the issue you're solving is actually downline for a much bigger problem. Because those people enlighten you to the real world. There's nothing theoretical about what they do. They have engine parts, nothing. And then you get the deer in the headlights look from senior manager who's trying to fix that when that is really the emergent. That is the triage point in a company. And then the next, of course, then you have to deal with the human part with the people who spoke up fear for their livelihoods. Because everybody has an empire to protect. And that's when you make a deal with the CEO to say, if you punish these people, you lose your workforce. Simple.
Yeah, yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
Make it known.
Well, it's just, when you think about it, again, we go back to something that's so obvious, which is the collective knowledge and intelligence that you have in any organization. It's how do you unlock that? And, you know, enable it to the whole organization to evolve as an organism, right? Because that's ultimately what you're building. You're building a temporary organism that comes together, a system. And, you know, everyone's got a part to play. And how can you make sure that knowledge flows freely? Because then we can act on it. We can do stuff. We can make changes. We can evolve. It's when you stop those lines of communication, we can't evolve because we get stuck.
Absolutely.
You know, and as I say, it's just systems thinking. It's just like, you know, if you looked at an organism, the cells have to communicate with each other some way for the health of the organism. It's no different to a company, right? So pretty obvious when you look at it, but pretty hard to do in practice.
Yeah, well, you know,
yeah, like most of these things. Come to halt,
publish something company wide that says there's a new initiative that we're pursuing as a company, and here's a list of the people involved in it. And you list all these people, the company stops. By the way, you just insured their jobs. That would be the purpose. So they're not going to get fired because they spoke up. And then you think that everyone else, oh, I didn't get invited. In fact, the opposite is true. If I work hard enough and contribute, I'll be invited next time, which is does not really follow human nature, but that's really what happens. And it's people come to you and say, did you have to put my name in the thing? Yeah. Yeah, why? Because you contribute as much as the CEO does. Go home, tell your wife this is a big deal.
It's nothing like a bit of motivation, isn't there? Motivation and encouragement and a bit of praise goes a long, long way, you know, well, massively. You know,
it's interesting, actually. So on that point, so just before I came on this call, I was talking to a company about how they might consider, you know, how do you live core values? You know, how do you make them real? And of course, you can do call outs and you can do that and you can give, you know, monetary rewards periodically if you're calling people out. But one of the suggestions that I had that seems to go down well is, if you are going to reward an employee with something like vouchers or something like that, partner it with a gift of a donation to any cause they choose. Because, of course, if you publish it to all the other employees, initially there's going to be, it's natural, they got a reward and I didn't, right? It's a natural human response. Whereas actually, if you said, well, they got a reward, but what's more important is they chose to donate to this thing that matters to them.
That's nice.
There's a little story because, you know, if I said to the two of you what matters to you, there'll be a personal connection. And it's hard to feel jealous of someone when they're making a difference to something that matters to them. So again, it's just a simple way of how do you live these things? Just use a little bit of humanity in these things. And, you know, it's peanuts for the company. But actually, it means something to the individual. It means something to the core.
That's gold. That's just pure
that's good.
Gold.
I like that. Yeah, I like that. So on to the next. I've got one question for both of you before I go into the closing kind of questions that I want to ask you personally, Richard. So, one future prediction that would surprise most people, like it could be anything. So, for the next sort of 3-4 years, is there something that you think? Is happening or going to happen or might happen? That's the sort of question that I'm looking for.
So I was wondering about that. And I think for me, it's the converging of research and understanding in consciousness, AI, and quantum mechanics. Because again, it's about systems thinking, and there's a lot of really interesting articles about the nature of consciousness, how potentially it relates to certain interesting aspects of quantum mechanics. And of course, then we're also going to have the debate of at what point would we call an AI conscious? And do we have levels of consciousness rather than it's a binary conscious or not? The convergence of some of those areas of science and theory and philosophy, I find quite fascinating.
Interesting. I find all of that very interesting. Certainly the consciousness and mass consciousness and how more and more people are understanding what's really going on in the world, that I find quite fascinating.
Even our own consciousness that we're here, there's still no real definition of what consciousness is beyond the sort of cellular, molecular level that we understand we are as a sort of carbon life form. And then, you know, understanding how does that relate to quantum mechanics and entanglement states, which then starts to say, okay, well, at what point do we create artificial life with AI? Because, yeah, passing the Turing test is one small bar, but going beyond that, I just think there's a fascinating, to me as a child in wonder, just saying, this is kind of cool. It's interesting.
It is cool. It is very cool. It's quite exciting. I'm excited about the whole world at the moment and what's going on. I think there are going to be lots of really good things that come out of this decade, to be honest. I think by the beginning of 2030, we're going to be in a very different place than we are now. I think a lot of these AI implementations will have failed. I think a lot of the hype will have died down. I think personally that the things that are working will be exceptionally good, because there's no room to actually have anything that isn't amazing.
Yeah, mediocrity is just not going
to
be there.
It's not there. It's not. There's no money to fund mediocre attempts at anything these days. To be honest, in this decade, that's what I'm excited about, is just cutting through all of the hype, getting rid of all the kind of just pointless stuff that's been going on, you know. So what do you think, Steve? What's your prediction for the next...
Well, a couple of things, if you forgive me, on mediocrity. Mediocrity done exceptionally well is what's real possible as a non sequitur. Good, let's fail spectacularly. That as a concept doesn't work for me. So it's to your fundamental question. I once again, early this morning, I called Nostradamus on the phone, and he took my call. The dead guy spoke to me and asked him the question. He said, to 100% certainty, in the next couple of years, I will not grow more hair. And then beyond that, you're on your own. It's moving too fast. It's not vertical. It's horizontal in every way for me to make any predictions that are worthwhile. That said, I think that probably the biggest thing, look, undeniably, I don't want my radiologist to read the MRI film. I want AI to do it. My next piece of surgery, my knees, after 2 years of discussion, Jason, the surgeon, will use a Stryker robot to do it, because he says, I'm the best, I get the best hands, but the robot's better. Okay, so that's just a side of this. That said, the biggest topic to me is singularity. What happens to the umpteen million people who think they're going to lose their jobs? And what's the likely? And of course, we talked ad nauseum about basic universal income, which I reject as a totally regressive concept. But singularity, and I certainly have some thoughts on that. That actually... creates an opportunity for, if you wish, quantum intellectual growth that's never happened before. And I have to go to McMillan, the guy who's the CEO of Walmart, said a couple of days ago. I love quoting this because it's like settles people down. He has 2.1 million employees, Walmart does. And of course, the answer to the series of questions was, in the next 3 years, he will still have 2.1 million employees. And by the way, that's not mirrors, Matt. It's the same people. It's not like we're going to get different people, or it's going to be a different construct. Going to hire more, fire more. As we grow, it's adjusted for all of that in his mind. His point is that he just made a deal with Altman, where he's going to offer 500,000 people the opportunity to learn AI. Okay, you're an employee, you're a greeter at a Walmart store, you're a package, truck driver, whatever the heck you are, sign up, you learn about AI. So within the next 1 year, 2 years, which is spellbinding, he's going to have a workforce that is not going to get fired, that's going to be equipped to use AI. So the guy driving the truck on the highway will understand the benefits of that. The packager person there is going to say, if I get this picking list differently, I can be more efficient. Now, that to me is the rosy colored glasses picture looking forward. So when people tell me I'm going to lose my job, oh my God, I said, well, let's think about what Walmart's doing in context. So you're on a company with 10 employees. You can replace five of them with these processes. How about we teach all 10 the use of this incredible newfangled thing? And instead of letting go of those 5, maybe 2 or 3 of those will come up with some much better ideas how to run our little liquor store, how to run our little shoe store.
Right, idea.
It's just quantumly forward in life and business and so on. That's a prayer I'd like to make.
That's a great idea. Yeah, I was thinking you said that the other day, but I think it's really come to light now, thinking about it again. I think that's really phenomenal, because they might invent new business models. There's all sorts of things that these people can do.
If we're governed by fear, it doesn't really work. We should be governed by opportunity, and we've got to, it's figure it out.
Exactly.
Well, that is where good leaders come in, like you, to teach those people about opportunity rather than fear. And that's a great leader. You know, it's a really, really good thing to tell people what to think. Okay. But the most elegant precept to me in leadership is to teach people how to think. Okay. So that is where you take that person from the rote business, the rote function, put that in their mind, train them, and then motivate them to do that. And now you have a powerful resource. And there's no,
absolutely,
the most awful to manage resource on earth is people. The most powerful resource on earth is people.
Well, I suppose this just goes back to, you know, what's the one of the definitions of a great leader, hopefully, is when you've actually created other great leaders.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And until then, you couldn't call yourself great.
Thank you.
Completely. That's why I'm working with Steve, because I'm getting leadership training.
You see, Richard, I fooled another one.
Yeah, good job. Well done. That's it. It's a pyramid scheme, right?
Yeah, I'm looking to put you on top of the darn scheme. It's easier.
I'm going to ask myself the next question. What am I working on right now that really excites me? I'm working on Monday Influencer with Steve, and I'm working on this podcast show, and I basically shelved everything else that I was doing. And I'm really excited about what we're building here. And I would ask you the same question, Steve, but you're going to say that hopefully the same answer. I don't know. Go on, Steve. Tell me, what are you excited about working on right now?
you mean not the private stuff? Okay. No, without a doubt, when we started Monday Influencer, I thought that had a number of things, a genuine purpose, you know, raison d'etre. There's a reason for it. It's just another business. Man, I can always sell phony uranium. I can sell traffic satellites. There's still 10 functioning Russian spy satellites over Western Europe that I can sell. Would you like to buy one? The price is going down as they're dying. I can always do that. So let's create something that actually delivers powerful insights, powerful tools. You know, hey, last week we did something on, I think we call it full stop. The brakes just went on. You lost your motivation. It happens to all of us frequently, more frequently admit to. And I go on to talk about, I have had the privilege of knowing many of the top tennis players in history. It's phenomenal to sit and have coffee or sit around with five guys, six, seven guys. They're all made top 20 in the world. I mean, that's the presence of greatness. And what derails the career? I lost my motivation. And never mind the health part, but I kind of lost my motivation. I couldn't find it until I hired Bob over there, who kicked my butt. Okay, so I was invited to sit in a group of people. You know, I used to be addicted to skiing, if you will, in my little spare time. 15 World Cup winners skiing. Starting back to Franz Klammer and Weber and Serbingen and these guys, I happened to be there because the guy who, they're all invited by this very large investment bank, and they have an event for them every year. And so happens I met the guy in an elevator on 6th Avenue in New York. And we got to chat. And then 2 weeks later, he called me and said, can you make it to New York for lunch tomorrow? You look at these guys, they're at the top of the top. Why did you quit, man? I don't know. Franz Klammer, the greatest downhiller of all time. I said, Franz, you were the best downhiller in the whole world when you quit. He said, now, I know the last race you ran, you came in 14th. Before that, you won 20 in a row. What happened? He said, you know, I was the best in the world on top of the mountain. 2 minutes and 5 seconds later, I was retired. Why? I just, no more. Then I have it. What happened? I just ran out of motivation. And the other guy said, yeah, that's exactly what happened. Yeah, I also broke my leg. But, you know, it's.
You know, that should be a separate topic, I think, for you.
But the point being, Monday influencer for me is a way to dispense strategies on for success in life and business. Because whatever anybody else thinks, it's all 80-20 or 90-10. 90% of people have 10% of the issues solving whatever the hell it is. So whether you're a multiple gold medal winner in skiing or a guy that was top six in the world, seven in the world, his brother was six, you know, and they all interesting what they react to. And not everything we write every week, and we do this every week, people want to know, how the hell do you do it every week? Because the topic is that big. I have no problem coming back with next one, you know, and just in the middle of the night, that we should write about this. And
it's a huge
we are dispensing the type of information advice that everyone says, yeah, okay. By the way, just to crow a little bit, it's been out there since January. We have yet to have a cancellation, which is a good thing. We must be doing something right. Oh, by the way, as I said before, one of the reasons for this was to create a vehicle to find money to donate to kids' causes. So what am I involved in? If I had to choose one, I'd be doing Monday Influencer. I'm excited to write for McGraw-Hill, for many thousands of college professors. Fool them, too, because they all have stuff I don't have. But, you know, I'm very excited to write the next two books, which I will if school just gets out of my email box long enough. You know, but yeah, bottom line enough. Is, it's cool to be at a stage, certainly in my life, where I profess shamelessly to have value, to dispense. More importantly, I'm a shameless researcher, just absolutely shameless. Put in perspective, I once called the Pope to ask a theological question, which is possible to do. So it's an amazing thing for me, and I talk about this all the time. The best of the best, the top of the top, the most relevant among the people who are relevant, the greatest people who achieve greatness, you, are amazingly accessible once you get the meaning. They are so glad to share, so glad to talk to you. And when you reach the top of the pinnacle, I was talking to a friend, I said, you're not going to believe it. I just talked to this guy. Why the hell would he talk to me? I'm an immigrant boy from a little town in Romania. Yeah, well, you know, I did go to law school a couple of times and all of that. But still, why? Because I asked some questions that truly intrigued them. And that filters right through what we write on the Monday Influencer. You know, we're not sitting
it's quite fun.
What I think is born out of knowledge that I may have, we may have. And this guy interviewed 500 darn people that are world renowned. So you learned a few things. Monday Influencer is a big deal for me. It's bigger than writing for a million college professors and the next book and all that, because it has value. And yes, February 2nd, we will write the first two checks. We'll write to charities.
Nice.
Cool. I'm excited about that.
How's that for a goal?
Yeah, that's a good goal. So Richard, on to you. What are you? I know a couple of things you're working on, but what are you working on right now that really excites you?
Well, I've been one of the things. I have a number of disparate things, but actually, I have a mentor that's helped me bring them all together. And what really excites me is And I'm going to use this phrase, and it's not mine, but it defines me. It's on the back of my business card. It's I get to do what I love with people I love to make a huge difference. And whether that's in the business areas I'm working in, whether it's a nonprofit, whether it's some of the one-to-one mentoring I do, ultimately, it's kind of trying to stay true to with the time that I have on this planet and the skill sets that I've developed or whatever, where do I play my best game? And constantly evaluate that to make sure that I'm playing my best game. And that could be with friends, it could be family, whatever. But how do I, because you know when you're in the zone, you know when you're just, that's where you're meant to be, where you're playing your best game, sweet spot. So it's trying to really tune into that in everything and saying, playing my sweet spot and make sure that I'm courageous enough to say no when actually it's not my sweet spot. It's not where I best play. And what I'm working on in terms of that, if I had to pick one, I'd say, I love all the stuff I do, but I want to build some engines to get £1 million or more, hopefully much more, back into community organizations to build almost like a heart bypass. So the money, because the money doesn't flow the way it should into community. So how do I build a bypass to get it in so that actually by the time I'm not on this planet anymore or I'm moved into a different form, I've contributed to something that lives well beyond to hopefully keep that funding going. So that's kind of perhaps what I'm working on. How can I come up with innovative business models, team up with great people? And actually part of that is just trusting, do you know what? It'll happen. You just put it out there, you talk about it enough, and magic happens. So, but you've got to spot the opportunity. But I know it will happen. I just don't know how.
Well, allow me.
100%.
Love to contribute if you can figure out how.
Yeah.
Because you never know, you know. Interesting things come out of the mouths of babes. And it's the last 100%. Guy or woman you expect to come up with a brilliant
idea. No, I know. Good, so you just never know. So the point is, you just stay open, childlike. It'll happen. I just don't know how.
In I like my that world,
childlike enthusiasm is what makes me tick, really, to be honest. But when it
in
when
my
it comes
world,
to,
one comment apropos yeah. what you just said. In my world, and I say this all the time, when thankfully we meet people like you, who do have genuine relevance and do have a great deal to contribute, I hasten to say, listen, Matt, the dumbest idea, the fleetingest idea that just kind of comes and goes in a big brain is worth a one-line email. It's going to take you 47 seconds to send me an email, send him an email. Yo, I think that we should be collecting dog excrement on college right. campuses for a living. That's exactly 40 seconds from scratch to write that email, or a text message for 17 seconds. The dumbest idea, the most fleetingest thought coming out of a truly high-level functioning brain is worth a one-line email. The response might be, have you sustained brain damage? Or, whoa, eureka, wow, never thought of that. What's the next step? And some of the greatest accomplishments, as you know, started out what was a germ of a silly kind of idea. And it's childish. A lot of the creative work that we've done starts out with 157 uses of the word green in advertising. Really? Okay. Now, the stupid part is what sometimes sparks the greatest idea. Yeah, it's just never done. Never know. Amazing things come out of mouths of babes.
So I absolutely agree. So I've got these three questions for you, Richard. First one is, you have said that profit should be an outcome of doing the right things with the right people. How can entrepreneurs practically shift from a profit-first mindset to a purpose-driven one without losing commercial success?
Well, I think they're two separate things because one is an outcome. And the other one is a how. And I think, you know, yeah, of course, if you take short-term profit, that will be, I get the fact you might do stuff. But if you're looking sustained profit, sustained success, then the how becomes important because you're talking about longevity. And so that's where understanding how human beings work, how they like to work, how to get the most out of them that's when the sort of principle centered. And I think also, you know, if you look at some of the stats that are coming out from the younger generations, I hate that phrase, but you know what I mean, that they really are interested in the why. Why, you know, what is it about you? What's, you know, they realize that the world's on fire. What are we doing as business people to make it slightly different? So I think it just makes sense. So one is about the how, but I also think, you know, profit on its own is a measure that that was given to us by an accounting set of practices. And I get that. But actually, we also need to look at some other measures as well, especially for long-term strategy. So it's one metric, but it might not be the only metric. Because what if you maximize profit and then you crash the next year? So is that important? So it's one measure, but it's not the only measure.
Okay. Thank you. So from your experience coaching leaders and building the Giving Machine, what have you learned about creating companies where people truly love to work? And why does that matter for long-term success?
I think what I've learned is going back to that people love to belong. They want a cause. People love a cause. And you can have a cause in a commercial organization. It could be just to delight your customers. people want to belong to something that matters. So you've got to, as a leader, you've got to create that. And if your business doesn't quite do it, then you as a leader, you can do that within your own team. Think of it like your own company. It doesn't have to be odds with the company, but you are responsible for the culture within your own team. So lead, make it happen. Make it so your team is amazing. People want to work in your team. And your team is contributing to helping other people feel great. One of the things we did in one of my teams was going back to the gift thing is, yeah, it's easy in a team meeting to start moaning about other people. Why don't you put into your team meeting, who's somebody in another team that's done a great job? And I used to buy $5 Starbucks vouchers and say, okay, who's going to walk that over and give that to a person to tell them, we think came up, your name came up in our team meeting, we think you did a great job. For $5, what a difference that makes in a culture. And it also means that the team meeting ends on a high rather than a moaning and a whinge. So the point is, if you want a different culture, create it. It really isn't that hard if you accept responsibility and do it. So what have I learned? I've just learned, actually, treat people like people, create the motivation, right? And magic just happens.
That's very profound, very profound. So you often talk about being childishly curious and using humor and humanity in leadership. How can leaders today use curiosity and authenticity to spark innovation and make a bigger impact?
Well, I think authenticity, first of all, is admitting your vulnerability. You don't know it all, and that's okay. That's not your job, is to know it all. Your job is to manage people effectively, leverage the intelligence and capabilities they have. Yeah, the buck stops with you to make a decision, but you can listen to everyone else's opinions first and you can canvas them. So I think part of that is the authenticity is it's okay. You don't need to know everything and show that vulnerability in front of your people. Be open, be honest, right? And I think have the courage to do that. And it's amazing, you know, when you can actually, when you mess up, you screw things up and you say, actually, yeah, screwed that up, sorry. What a difference that makes is when you try and cover up and do stupid stuff, it makes you look like a complete fool. So I think with that, humor is difficult because it depends on you as an individual and how you relate to humor. For me, it's a weapon of choice because once you can get people laughing, even if they're just laughing at you, actually, completely removes a lot of tension in the room. But it's not something you can when you watch politicians try and use humor and it bombs because it's not natural, it's not authentically them. Someone else has written the script. So I think it's a difficult one to use. You have to use it in whatever may make sense. But the benefit of using humor and being able to laugh at yourself first, at the stupidity that we are as individuals sometimes. How, you know, important, I mean, in my own family, how important it is to me to sit in the one chair I like to sit in the living room and how irritated I get if someone else sits in it. and just laugh at myself about how stupid I'm really being. And you know, that sort of stuff. So if we can laugh at ourselves first and understand some of the stupid things we do, then at least hopefully other people can see we don't take ourselves too seriously. And therefore, really, we shouldn't take everything else quite so seriously from that perspective. So that's where I would say be open, be vulnerable, be honest. That's the authenticity is just don't hide behind stuff because you think you should. And you said earlier, you know, about challenges and stuff. Every single person you speak to and I would speak to has got their own bucket of crap. It's just some people are better at hiding it than others.
Yeah, 100%. We all do. It's interesting that, you know, and some people are that close to just snapping, whereas other people are, you know, have a bit of a bigger gap there, right? And you don't know. You don't know what's going on in someone else's life because you only see this much. You only see what they're
willing to share.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So I know you've given... Go on, Steve. You had something to say.
Everybody has two agendas. The one you see and then the ulterior motive. Everybody has two. You know, you need to figure out how to manage
that. But then
that.
I think part of that then is having the courage to try and make that into one.
That what make you an elite leader.
Completely. Completely. And I think we're always trying to improve, aren't we? I mean, that's the whole beauty of life, you know, and continual learning. And the people that are not continual learners are the ones that are really going to struggle. And I think they probably have always struggled. But the problem is now is that the rate of change is so fast in most industries that those people are actually going to struggle quicker than they would have maybe 5 years ago, because the pace of change wasn't so fast, you know?
No, you're right. But then I think it's incumbent upon those of us who are leaders to create an environment where it's okay to be vulnerable and say, do you know, I'm struggling.
Yeah.
You know, and to create that environment where it's okay to be honest and open, and then we can deal with stuff. It's when you hide stuff and you pretend it's not there, that's when all the problems come. So I think, you know, for those of us hopefully who are thinking like that, it's up to us to create the right environments to help everyone else along. That you can't force someone, and you can only invite them, and maybe some people won't pick up the baton, but at least you gave them the opportunity.
Well, you can try and inspire as many people as possible. I mean, that's what we try and do. We try and inspire people because we are passionate about ongoing learning and continued professional development. And hopefully that passion will be delivered to other people through our enthusiasm. I mean, that's my goal and Steve's goal with what we're doing here. But you've given a challenge to the listeners. And what Richard says is, he says, ask yourself, what is the positive impact of your business, your team, or just you could make if you really lived your core values? And please share and inspire others is basically what he's saying. Is there anything you wanted to add to that, Richard?
The one thing I would add on that is, if that feels a bit too nebulous, then think of the key people you are connected to right now. And in 20 years' time, there's a big birthday and they're all going to say a few words about you, about the impact you've had on them and how you've made them feel, whether that's your family, your friends, the people that work for you, with you, your customers, people you've sort of, I don't know, been around, co-workers, whatever. What would you want them to say about the impact you've had and how you made them feel? And then make that happen, because it doesn't happen by accident.
That's very profound. That's very profound.
Well, it's writing your living eulogy, you know.
Yeah, completely.
That's why I said birthday. I said that's birthday because I don't like the idea of this. you're dead, right?
Hopefully I'm not going to be in 20 years, but, you know, Steve thinks I probably will, the speeds I go on my motorcycle, but that's just him thinking that. He's just trying to tell me to be careful.
I'm trying to tell you, riding a motorcycle at 170 miles an hour may not be the smartest thing to do.
But my tyres are rated at 169.
Mind you, in a few years' time, though, we'll be able to bottle your consciousness, right? So it'll be fine.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. Hey, it was on. It was on. It was on a landing strip, right? So you know.
So yeah, it is what it is. But yeah, you weren't doing that down Highway 101 or something like that. No.
No. Well, thank you. I've thoroughly enjoyed speaking with you, and thanks so much, Steve. Thanks to everyone for listening.
Thank you both. Well, we'll drop some links to learn from you.
Yeah, we do. Masses of stuff. And we'd like to talk more because we've got so many questions here that we have not answered.
Thanks very much for listening to Influential Visions. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thanks.